there, I'm Dr. Trevor Cates. Welcome to the Spa Doctor Podcast. Today we're talking about men's health and the prostate. Whether you're a man or a woman, what we're talking about today very likely impacts your life. My guest today is Dr. Gio Espinoza, a renowned naturopathic and functional medicine doctor recognized as an authority in urology and men's health. Dr. Gio is the founder and director of the Integrative and Functional Urology Center at New York University Langone Medical Center and lectures internationally on the application of integrative urology in clinical settings. He's been recognized as one of the top 10 health makers for men's health by ShareCare.com, created by Dr. Oz and WebMD. Dr. Gio is the author of the new book, Thrive, Don't Only Survive, Dr. Gio's Guide to Living Your Best Life Before and After Prostate Cancer. Prostate cancer affects 1 in 7 men. So on today's show, we talk about how prostate cancer may impact your life more than you realize, similarities with breast cancer, and specific dietary lifestyle factors and supplements for prostate cancer prevention and co-management. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Gio. Dr. Gio, it's great to have you on my podcast.
It's such a pleasure to be on your podcast. I think the last time I did a summit with you, right? Not a podcast. This is our first podcast.
Yeah. So I've interviewed you before, but this is the first time you've been on the podcast.
And it's a pleasure.
Absolutely. And we're talking about something a little bit different. This is a topic we have not covered on the Spa Doctor before, and that is we're talking about prostate and prostate cancer. So let's start off by, most of my audience are women. And then we definitely have men that are that watch and listen to the podcast too. Why do women in particular, what do women need to know about prostate cancer? And why is, you and I were just talking before we started about why it's so important. Like, why do women care about this?
Listen, the first thing that I tell all women, I think your women audience should know, is that if they read my prostate cancer book, I can 100% guarantee them that they'll never develop prostate cancer. So that's the first thing I think your audience should know. But let me say this. Women don't have a prostate. Now, you would think every woman knows that, but I remember teaching way back when I was taught at a college. And, we're talking about urinary systems and urinary problems and prostate problems that are associated with urinary systems. A young lady raises her hand. She says, Dr. Espinoza, I have those problems. Urinary problems, I think I have a prostate problem. So from that point on, I just, took nothing for granted. So I just want to let women know who are listening that women don't have a prostate. So that's why they'll never develop prostate cancer. Even if they just read my book, they don't even have to apply anything. Anyway, we'll go right into the question. So what was the question?
So why would women care about this then? I mean, women don't have prostates, but why is it so important?
All right, here's the deal, right? Number one, your man is getting up 2, 3, 4, 5 times a night to go urinate. You're a light sleeper. Every time he gets up, you get woken up. And that's a common complaint that I see from women. Why is he getting up 3, 4, 5 times a night to go urinate, right? Number two, sexual dysfunction associated with an enlarged prostate. So there's many reasons why some men suffer from sexual dysfunction or erectile dysfunction. Well, this affects women also. This just doesn't affect men. I think we get lost in this thing that, it's only affecting the man. Men can't get it up and they can't perform. No, this is a quality of life issue also for women. And that can be a problem associated from an enlarged prostate, because what happens? You have the pudendal nerves that come wraps around the prostate and goes right into the penis, involved in the process of erections. But if that prostate is too enlarged, it's going to impinge and push up against these nerves where the man is not going to be able to get an erection. The third thing is that men are diagnosed with prostate cancer after a certain time in their life. About 1 out of every 6 men will be diagnosed. So there's somebody in your audience who has a loved one, whether it's their partner, a father, or a brother that's had prostate cancer. I can almost guarantee it. So what happens? Well, what happens is that women play such a critical role throughout this process. whether it has to do with screening or decision-making as to, you know, what do we do as a treatment? Bottom line is this. I tell all my patients, all my male patients, if you have a woman in your life, and, you know, most do, even if it's just a partner, sister, mother, what have you, they need to come in. They need to come in. Why? They ask better questions. They're paying close attention to what I'm saying. And they just take better notes. And they're an integral part. Like, men shut down. Like, once a man gets diagnosed with prostate cancer, that's it. There's nothing else coming in. And women play a major role because they're more attentive. They sometimes even more astute. And once again, asking better questions. So prostate problems, prostate cancer affects almost every woman in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And for men that are watching, listening too, it certainly is something that you want to be aware of. So let's back up now. Now that we know why we're covering this on the podcast,
right?
Let's back up and talk about the prostate, where it is, right, what its role is, and when. Let's start with that.
The prostate, the pesky prostate, is right underneath a man's bladder. So first you have the bladder, then you have right beneath the bladder, you have the prostate. And there's a tube that goes from the bladder through the prostate called the urethra. And the purpose of that tube is to bring out urine and semen out of the urethra, right? Women have a urethra much shorter than men. The problem is that urethra is found in the middle of the prostate, right smack in the middle, give or take an inch or two. So what happens when the prostate gets inflamed, or something called BPH, or benign prostatic hyperplasia, where there's a lot of cells growing, sometimes, or even prostate cancer, it closes in on the urethra, causing urinary problems. The primary function of the prostate is for conception and fertility. That's it. That's what it does. I mean, not that's it. I mean, there'd be no life as we know it without that important function, but that's what it does. It produces about 65% of the semen. So prostate glands produce about 65% of the semen. And once again, that urethra, that tube that brings out the urine and semen, it's enclosed by the prostate. So anything that encloses the urethra will indeed cause any type of urinary problems, urinary frequency, urgency, getting up at night to urinate, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, great. So then when does it become a problem? What are some warning signs, some screening things that people should be aware of, whether you're a man or a woman? So if you're a woman, it's for your man, or
absolutely,
a man in your life, or if you're a man, what are the things that you want to be looking for and screening?
Absolutely. Great question. Because the other thing, you know, I think we got really screwed up with the Y chromosome, to be honest with you, because we, you know, men just kind of fight through. They don't pay attention to certain things. They just fight through. You know, we kind of survivors. We're the hunters. We go and we bring back, you know, the food, and nothing else matters. So we fight through things, you know. But anytime, so a man can get up 3 to 4 or 5 times a night to go urinate, and they may ignore these symptoms. Just ignore them. Oh, it's just life, or it's just the fact that I'm getting older. So getting up at night to urinate more than once is okay, particularly if they're older than 50 or 60, and or they've had numerous drinks the night before. Getting up one time a night is fine. To urinate twice is okay. More than 2 times a night, that's a problem. There's either overactive bladder going on, or there's a prostate problem. The other thing is blood in the urine. Blood in the urine can mean many things. Sometimes it means absolutely nothing, but it can also mean prostate cancer, kidney stones, and or bladder cancer. An erection. I always say that the penis is a barometer to a man's health. So whether, you know, the couple, you know, sometimes couples are not intimate, sometimes they are. But even if there's no intimacy, that question of, you know, if they feel really comfortable with each other, can he get an erection? if, you know, there's many reasons. This is not to say that, you know, a couple go, they go into the bedroom and he can't perform. And my God, he, you know, he's going to have a heart attack. That's not the case. There's many reasons why men can't perform at once or twice, psychological mostly. But if it happens consistently of, you know, 3-4 times in a row, then there's something there. And it can still be psychological. It can still be the dynamic between the woman and the man. Or it can be physiological, plaques in the arteries that are being clogged up. Where if there's clogged up plaques in the arteries of the penis, where else are there, you know, plaques in arteries? Is it the heart or anywhere else? So it's a health issue. So prolonged erectile dysfunction can mean there's some sort of cardiovascular issue going on.
Right. Okay. So these are some of the warning signs to look for. And then, so if you have these issues, you want to go talk to a doctor.
A naturopathic or functional medicine doctor. That's very important. It's important because most conventional doctors have a conventional mindset. And by the way, I don't disparage conventional doctors. I work throughout my career as a naturopathic doctor. I've worked with urologists and medical doctors, but you got to see it for what it is. Most conventional doctors will prescribe Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra, and then call me in the morning kind of deal and see how that works. That's a Band-Aid approach. That's a Band-Aid approach. So we are masking by doing that a bigger problem, whether it's cardiovascular or diabetes setting in or something. So while I'm not completely, you know, against these drugs, you have to always look for the cause first. So I would say that, you know, that's why it's important to seek the help of somebody, a naturopathic functional medicine. They look at the whole picture. I mean, I can't tell you how my patients love of the fact that I'm looking at the whole picture. I'm not just looking, you know, this wonderful idea that the lower half of the body is connected to the upper half of the body. Oh my God. What a concept. What a concept. So I think people in general appreciate that. And certainly men do as well. And their partners love it. They love the fact that, you know, men are seeking out these kind of holistic approaches.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So now how common is prostate cancer?
How common is prostate cancer? Let's see. About 220,000 men are diagnosed with prostate cancer in the United States. About 31,000 men die from prostate cancer in the U.S. About 1 million men die from prostate cancer worldwide. So it's the most common cancer in men. And it's the second most deadly in men. So it's very common. It's very common. It's analogous to breast cancer in women. And this is why I said earlier that, most women know of a loved one who've had it, or they will know of a loved one who've had it.
Mm-hmm, right.
Or have it.
Yeah. And so what age does this usually become a problem? Is this something that happens at a certain age?
Good question. Another great question. Why is that a great question? It's because you can't really go by what the United States Preventive Task Force suggests, because they would suggest over 50, it's an old man's disease, no PSA test should. So PSA is the blood marker associated with prostate health and or prostate cancer. So what we know is that the PSA is a very poor marker for prostate cancer specifically, and I get that. But it's still pretty good. It's okay. So it's not a matter of should we test or not. Is the matter what you should focus on is what do you do with that information once you get it. So all that to say that if there's a first-degree family member with prostate cancer and or breast cancer in women, so there's a higher risk of men developing prostate cancer in those that have a first-degree family member with breast cancer as well. So If they have a family, first family degree member, which means a brother, a father, or a mother, then they should start screening at the age of 40. Very important, very important. I just had a patient the other day who's 44 years old, not only with prostate cancer, but really with the type of prostate cancer that should be treated surgically. Now, this same guy would have had, why is that important? Because most 44-year-olds don't screen. The United States Preventative Task Force would say, oh, why screen? Well, his father had aggressive prostate cancer. He has aggressive prostate cancer at 44. If he would have ignored it, by the age of 49 and 50, he would have had metastatic prostate cancer disease, and he would have been in very deep trouble. Now, we still have a chance of, you know, curing him from surgery and aggressive lifestyle interventions.
Mm-hmm. So the PSA is a blood marker that people should start testing. Men should start testing at around 40 years old then.
Particularly men that have a first degree family member of either prostate cancer or breast cancer. If there's no family history of cancer, I would start around 50 years old. That means a PSA test and the good old finger test, which is the prostate exam that most men, of course, try to avoid.
Yeah. So, but it is an important exam because it'll give you a lot of information. It gives us a lot of information about the health of the prostate.
It's old school. It's old school.
This test.
Exactly.
I remember this from medical school. This is what a healthy prostate feels
that's
like.
Right. That's right. This is prostatitis.
Yep.
Right. This is BPH. No, this is BPH. Okay. This is more like BPH, and your knuckle is like a nodule, a hard nodule.
Right.
That's prostate cancer. So yeah, those are the things we're looking for.
Okay. Yeah. So that's when you have a doctor feeling your prostate exam, that's what they're kind of feeling for, is that those differences and the feel of it. And that the digital exam, that is usually done starting at 50, or do you recommend people start before then also?
First family degree history of prostate cancer or breast cancer, that starts at 40. If there's no family history, you start at 50.
Okay.
All things being equal, this is specifically for prostate cancer. Sometimes every now and then you have the 28-year-old with prostatitis. So, you have to do the exam. But for prostate cancer, you start around 50 or 40 if there's a family history.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I know with the PSA test on the blood work, there are different ones on the labs. There's screening versus diagnostic. Do you want to say anything about the difference between those?
Yeah, well, this total PSA and this free PSA, free PSA, if the percentage of the PSA is low, let's say lower than 20%, that can indicate, is not an end-all be-all, there's a lot of false positives, but that can indicate that there's some prostate cancer if it's less than 24% of the PSA is free. The total is a total number that people typically look at between 0 to 4, but you know, you could be at a 4.2, and if you are 62, that's not that high. What you really want to look at is how does it change within time? So not just that one number, but how does the PSA change, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months later? That can be more indicative. So the rate of change can be more indicative of some problem going on in the prostate. If it's beyond 10 total, let's say 15, 20, then there's a higher likelihood of there being prostate cancer there than just growth of the prostate.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So say someone has been diagnosed with prostate cancer. What are some things that people should realize when they are diagnosed with prostate cancer?
Right.
From a more functional medicine, naturopathic medicine approach, what do you usually recommend?
Well, here's the first thing. The first thing is that you have time to make a decision as to what you need to do in terms of if you do need a conventional therapy, whether it's surgery, removal of the prostate, or radiation or many, there's like, I don't know, 8 other treatments out there in this day and age. There's HIFU, there's CyberKnife, there's proton beam radiation. There's a tons of things out there. Bottom line is, don't make a fast decision just to kind of get it over with. You may make those kind of get it over with decisions in other aspects of your life, but this is not one of those areas that you should do that. Because this is a, it could be a life, this is a lifelong process. The other thing is that some individuals, some men are a candidate for active surveillance, meaning that low grade cancer, that they may not need any conventional treatments at all. And they're followed closely by their practitioner. So that's the first thing. Should I get it treated or should I not? And then not to make a quick decision. And if they do need to get it treated conventionally, to do it, to visit with at least 3 doctors before they make a decision. Either way, whether they're on active surveillance or they are on, you know, or they need aggressive conventional treatment, they still should follow an aggressive lifestyle intervention that we call it at the office, the Kaplis method. Kaplis is an acronym, capital C, lowercase a, capital P is for carcinoma of the prostate, L is for lifestyle, E is for exercise and eating, 1 S is for sleep and stress management, the other S is for supplementation. So the Kaplis method is a focused lifestyle, prescriptive type of lifestyle plan for men with prostate cancer. Either way, they need either, you know, particularly if they go on active surveillance, is a no-brainer. But even because men are, once again, sometimes men are a little bit hard-headed. I don't know if you've noticed that, Dr. Cates. Men can be a little hard-headed. So they kind of, what happens sometimes is that they get it treated, right? If they get it treated with a prostatectomy, let's say, okay, that's it. My prostate is out. The cancer is out. I don't have to worry about anything. I could just live my, you know, reckless lifestyle again. And the answer is no. The answer is no, because men who get prostate cancer conventionally treated with surgery or radiation have a 40 to 50% chance of a recurrence within 5 to 10 years. I'll repeat that, because actually that's very important. So you get diagnosed with prostate cancer, and you say, well, wow, my goodness, I have to go through surgery and, you know, possibly be impotent and have urinary incontinence. But you know what? It's worth it. It's worth it because the cancer will be out. Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. There's a 40 to 50% chance that it comes back within 5 to 10 years. More so, do one has to be even more, pay more attention to their specific lifestyle, which now we can create a microenvironment that's hostile to cancer cells. It's not just the prostate, it's the body, the whole body that's cancering.
Yeah, and it's so important. And again, I think this is another reason why it becomes part of the involvement of you know, women or, you know, husbands, you know, it's like a family thing. Because when we're talking about lifestyle changes, it's something that has to happen within the family. So
that's right.
And a lot of times women are the ones maybe being involved in the food preparation or the shopping. So lifestyle changes are a family thing. So
that's right. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of those lifestyle changes that are so important for people with prostate cancer, and really for, they're probably good for all of us, but particularly for prostate cancer is what we're talking about.
So I have good news. The good news is that the Kaplis method actually works well for women, because 95% of the stuff that we're going to discuss that works for men with prostate cancer works for women and breast cancer and prevention of breast cancer and co-management of breast cancer. So breast cancer and prostate cancer are cousins, right? How they function, how they develop, how they progress are very similar. So oftentimes I have to look at the breast cancer literature to extrapolate from there and look, and then apply some of these concepts to prostate cancer, and they work really well. So absolutely, it should be a family type of lifestyle change. So in saying that, we'll kind of run through it very quickly, the type of things that they're more in detail in other, you know, the book and other places, but we'll kind of touch on the different elements of the capitalist method. Diet, what do you eat? What do you eat and what don't you eat, right? Well, what you don't eat is refined carbohydrates and simple sugars. I think your audience kind of heard this before with regards to inflammation and aging and so on. It plays a critical role with regards to cancer. So sugar does feed cancer. I mean, many people have heard that, and I don't think that many people think that's just theatrics or an exaggeration. It's not. When you do a PET scan, right, you feed your body with a sugar solution, and the areas of cancer cells, they light up where you can see it on the screen. Those that when they gobble up all the sugar in a PET scan. So refined carbohydrates, I tell you, and it's addictive, but it has to be something that needs to be eliminated. So then the next question becomes, wait a minute, paleo and ketogenesis, what do we do with that? Does that mean no whole grains? Does that mean no fruit? Here's the deal. I like to think that I'm pretty abreast with the literature with regards to diet and cancer. And there's a lot of talk on ketogenesis, which means eating almost no carbohydrates at all and using ketones for energy, not glucose. Ketones is what your body makes from fat to create energy, as opposed to using glucose. And then the paleo folks are saying, no, paleo. Okay, what do you do? What's the bottom line? What's the truth? With regards to prostate cancer and breast cancer, the ketogenesis diet, they've looked at brain cancer mostly, and they've seen very good results with brain cancer. Not all cancers are created equal. So prostate cancer and breast cancer are much different than colon cancer and brain cancer, right? So then, I mean, if you're going to put somebody on a program, I'm sorry to jump around, but this is very important. Here we go. The diet that's good but sustainable is better than the perfect diet that's not sustainable, right? So if it's a good diet, but they can't keep it up, if ketogenesis become too hard, or then it doesn't do any good. So in the capitalist eating program, because I try not to use the word diet too much, I really don't like that word, I detest that word. The eating program requires very low glycemic index foods, foods that are not, don't go into your system too quickly that causes a huge surge of insulin. Low glycemic index, no refined carbohydrates, some whole grains, blueberries and berries, which have shown to have anti-cancer properties. Apples show to have had anti-cancer properties. Meats are actually fine. Most people are saying, oh, no meat, no meat. No, meats are fine for most. What matters is how you prepare them. So if it's charred or overly cooked, high temperature, it's not good. Organic grass-fed is absolutely better. There's no question about that. And cold cuts are not good. They've shown that cold cuts and processed meats actually promote cancer. Okay? So if you're going to have meats, have grass-fed organic cooked in, at low temperature. Fish is number one. You and I both know, you know, our friends from Vital Choice. I'm like a poster child for Vital Choice. I love their fish. They're wonderful. Good quality fish is very good. The number one vegetable, which all vegetables are good, there's not one that are bad, not even carrots, which have some sugar. Carrot juice, I would not suggest, even if it's freshly squeezed. But carrots are fine. They're the cruciferous vegetables from the brassica family, right? Things like cauliflower and Brussels sprouts and broccoli. They create this chemical called isothionates that actually have anti-cancer properties. I mean, they're the number one food. They should be cooked. The reason why I'm saying that, because the raw food people would say, oh my God, no, only raw, because the enzymes, they're going to kill off the enzymes. these cruciferous vegetables need to be cooked because in order to free up these chemicals called sulforaphanes, so that your body creates the good things from these sulforaphanes that are anti-cancer, you need to release I don't want to be overly scientific here, but a myrosinase type of enzyme that converts the sulforaphanes into isothionates, which have the good things in it, the anti-cancer properties. But they should be cooked, not burned, but cooked. The other thing is that uncooked cruciferous vegetables can mess up the thyroid, right? Because it's called goitrogens. So they can cause hypothyroid. And I've seen that happen actually clinically, which is pretty interesting. So the cruciferous vegetables are number one, and they should be cooked. And that's diet. Exercise three hours a week of moderate intensity, and no less than 3 hours a week of moderate intensity. 4 hours is better. 5 is great. More than 5, you might be overdoing it. So people who like to run marathons and things and ultra marathons, excessive skiing, maybe, I don't know, out there, out in Park City, I don't know. Is there such a thing as excessive skiing? I'm such a New Yorker. I don't even, like, I just made that up. I was like, is there such a thing? Can you ski excessively? I don't know. Probably not, I don't know.
I think that's all perspective.
It is.
I've never had a patient come in from excessive skiing.
Oh, right. So 3 hours a week of moderate intensity. Your audience could look up what moderate intensity means. I don't want to kind of belabor that, but moderate intensity meaning sweating, meaning heart rate up, etc. If they're on androgen deprivation therapy, also called hormone therapy, which means the patient gets chemically castrated, they need to do weight resistance 3 days a week. Okay? Very important. Very important. Why? Because you deplete the body of testosterone, what goes up? The risk of osteosporosis or weakening of the bones. What goes up? Metabolic syndrome. What goes up? Fat all over the waist, which now they're at a risk of other things. Weight resistant exercise is incredibly important if they are chemically castrated with hormone therapy. With regards to supplements, I use quite a few supplements that create this microenvironment that's hostile to cancer. Grapeseed extract studies. I mean, everything that I do is pretty much evidence-based, science-based. Grapeseed extract. Curcumin, which comes from turmeric, anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, EGCG or ECG, EGCG. Yeah, I think that's how it is. I always get those confused. From green tea extract, vitamin D3, anywhere between 2,000 units and 5,000 units a day. With a lot of our colleagues, I sometimes disagree. Sometimes they think more is better. So the blood test, the range is between 30 and 100 nanograms per milliliter. Some people like to have them around 100. I'm not quite sure that's the right thing to do. I think that if a little bit is good, more doesn't mean better. You look at the literature, people with around 30 to 40 do great and show
vitamin
D3 levels. So that usually, the dosage is typically about between 2 to 5,000 units a day, depending on the size of the patient. The bigger they are, the more they need. I use boswellia, which is an excellent anti-cancer herb. I know it's used for joint and osteoarthritis and things like that. Boswellia is an excellent anti-cancer herb. I use pomegranate extract, selenium from Seleno XL specifically. It's there was a study in 1996 showing a 63%. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, very conservative, very well known. And they showed that those that consumed this particular type of selenium had a 63% reduction rate of prostate cancer. I could go on and on, but that's a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so just to recap on that, you talked about diet, and I think that everything you talked about sounds absolutely fantastic. Just for clarification, though, do you think that ketosis is helpful with prostate cancer, or is it just that you think that it's not sustainable? You think that it is beneficial, but it's not sustainable.
Here's the deal. There's no literature on ketosis and prostate cancer, not in animals, not in humans. Now, obviously, you know, you and I are in the trenches, right? Doctors are in the trenches. So we can't wait for the 15-year study to say, hey, yeah, ketosis. So oftentimes we have to extrapolate from the research that does exist and see how that works with our patients. Mm-hmm. So I'm not opposed to ketosis. In fact, here's another part of the dietary part that I failed to mention. Another part of the capitalist method is intermittent fasting. Intermittent fasting, what does that mean? That means you eat for a certain period of the day and you don't eat or just drink water for another part of the day. I typically do 12-hour fasting, a fasting a day, meaning let's say 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. or something like that. Sometimes I ask them to do 16 hours every other day. Well, that can potentially induce ketosis, potentially, depending on what else they eat. So, and then I have some other patients who do their, you know, they go to Dr. Google and say, oh, ketosis is good. I'm going to do ketosis. Great. Do ketosis. Yeah, I could do the ketogenic diet. I'm following them closely. But for the person that's used to living the SAD lifestyle, which is the standard American diet lifestyle, who just got diagnosed, to, you know, I have to put them on a program that's science-based, that's specific. Prostate cancer. I think that's important. That's specific. So when you look at the literature, you see Dean Ornish's lifestyle on prostate cancer, and it says, you know, it's a plant-based diet with actually very low fat, which I don't think, I mean, there was different components and variables in it. So you can't just say it's from the diet, but you cannot ignore it either. So when you look at the, literature, it's not just ketosis. But once again, those patients that are on a ketogenic diet, I leave them on it.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on ketosis. I know some people might be wondering, what is this? But you can certainly find out more about that. We're not going to delve into that a lot today. But I do think it's interesting to look at what the research shows and what science is out there right now and what people's experience are. So that's why I wanted to ask about that clarification on that. But it sounds like in general, what you're talking about is eating more fish, eating when you choose meats to choose grass-fed, free-range kinds of meats and the brassica vegetables that are so important and also things like berries that are full of antioxidants. Those are some of the big things with diet. And then exercise 3 hours a week of cardio and then adding in 3 hours of weight or resistance exercise if you want to boost your testosterone levels.
Not necessarily to boost testosterone, but one of the therapies for prostate cancer, particularly aggressive prostate cancer, is castration, chemical castration. So you get the testosterone down to zero. So in order to protect your body from metabolic syndrome and weak bones, then what's required is weight resistance. It's not going to boost testosterone levels necessarily.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then you talked about some supplements. So I think those are all really fantastic components to help people with prostate cancer. And anything else that you would add into that you have in your book or that you wanted to point out?
Yeah. Sleep 12 hours a night, which no one in New York does. I mean, come on. I say that with tongue in cheek because you remember naturopathic school, you always have the sleeper groups, right? The sleep groups. And they always say, well, you know, 12 hours, that's what's needed. And who does that? I mean, are you going to get anything done if you sleep 12? So, I mean, you got to be holistic, but realistic. So 7 hours a night is the dosage, right? Give or take. Look, life is hard. I know I get 7 hours a night, maybe three times a week. I mean, other times I just get 5 hours, you know, so life is hard. Then is 10 minutes of either meditation or mindfulness or deep breathing exercises, just 10 minutes a day, which, you know, that's digestible for most people, metaphorically speaking. You know, they can do that. And those are the main things. We talk about the 21-day reset, capless reset program, where for 21 days, you're very clean with your diet, with your lifestyle for just 21 days. And that kind of, you know, is a jump start, if you will, on getting on the program.
Great. And then, of course, with any type of cancer, it's important to for people to not try and treat themselves, treat cancer on their own, or even just, I think we need to look at it as an integrative approach. You need to talk to your oncologist. You need to work with a naturopathic doctor, a functional medicine doctor. It's part of the teamwork. You have to, I think it's important to have a whole team of people to help you. Your family is part of your team. And I think that's how people are most successful in beating cancer and keeping.
That's the only way. It's really a multidisciplinary approach. I could tell your audience right now, and with almost 100% certainty, that if their loved one, this is assuming there are very little men listening to this show right now, because, you know, with 100% certainty almost, that if they just take the conventional route, they are shortchanging themselves, and they're not going to, you know, be able to really heal, really cure themselves, and really live their best life moving forward. They're just not. They need to include a naturopathic doctor. Look, they have the ONC-ANP. They have the Oncological Fellowship Association for Naturopathic Physicians. Go to the ONC-ANP, ONC-ANP, and .com or .org, and you could get you can find a doctor that's, you know, that's naturopathically inclined.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is important to go to a functional medicine doctor that specializes in this, because not all naturopathic doctors or functional medicine doctors are going to know exactly what you're talking about. And certainly, you've got this book now that's a great resource for people. So tell us a bit about your book, how this came to be, and how people can find it.
Well, I do feel like I gave birth around 2.5 weeks ago. I mean, it feels like that. Certainly the funny feelings in my gut are very similar to when my kids were born. It's called Thrive, Don't Only Survive, Dr. Gio's Guide to Living Your Best Life Before and After Prostate Cancer. It's really a culmination of about 8-9 years of experience. Well, actually, I have about 12 years of experience dealing a lot with prostate cancer. I'm at NYU here in New York as director of the Integrative and Functional Urology Center. So I see a lot of guys with prostate cancer, and like in-depth research, like world research on what is it? What is it that we really need to do? There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of confusion as to what to do. And I wanted to make it as dummy-proof as possible. And it's really a prescription. There's a minimum. That's what we call the lowest therapeutic dose of what to do with exercise. That lowest therapeutic dose is 3 hours a week. The literature is very, very clear, the scientific literature, that those that exercise with moderate intensity for 3 hours a week don't die as often from prostate cancer as those compared to those that don't. So it's Thrive, Don't Only Survive. It's, you know, there's a website. We're developing an amazing community on capless thrivers. These are people that, you know, they're not looking at life as a survival thing. You know, survivor. I have a hard time with that word. I have a hard time because, yes, of course you want to survive. Of course that you have to survive first. But, you know, words are powerful. Words have an effect on your nervous system inside of your body. So survivor implies I'm kind of just making it. You know, I'm just hanging in there, barely just hanging in there. And thriver means no. As a result of this diagnosis, I'm going to actually live a better life. I'm going to live my best life as a result of prostate cancer. So prostate cancer is an opportunity to live your best life. So that's what this book is about. That's what the community is about. And I'm very excited about it. It's really, you know, it's changing lives.
Excellent. I'm so excited for you. And so if you're listening and you're a man and you're over 40, especially if you have family history of any of breast or prostate cancer, if you're having any symptoms, something to consider, think of this book. Or if you're a woman and you have someone in your life that you're concerned about with their prostate health, I think this is a book you want to get, because there aren't many things, you know, things out there like this. I don't know where else you find this information.
Thank you. Yep. I agree, but I wrote the book, so I'm a little bit biased.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks you so much, Dr. Geo, for your information today and coming on with you for your interview. Really appreciate it.
It's totally my pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed this interview today with Dr. Geo Espinoza. To learn more about Dr. Geo and his new book, you can visit my website, thespadoctor.com. That's Dr. abbreviated DR. Go to the podcast page with his interview, and you'll see all the information and links there. Also, I invite you to join the Spa Doctor community on my website or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you don't miss any of our upcoming shows. If you haven't done so already, I highly recommend you get your customized skin report at theskinquiz.com. It's free, and based upon the answer to just a few questions, you'll get your own customized skin profile, theskinquiz.com. Also, don't miss out on the latest tips for glowing skin and vibrant health. Join us on social media on Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, and Instagram. Join the conversation. I hope to see you there. Thank you, and I'll see you next time.